There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jimmy hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, broadcasting to you in beautiful high-definition audio, or something quite like it, to all four corners of the globe, this greenish-blue planet that we call our Earth, hurling through space. Phil here, everyone. How are you doing? Back in the saddle here. Ripping off podcasts left and right, staying up with what's going on. And so grateful that you join us all the time. Please email me, phil@philpritchett.com. Let me know you're listening out there. Also, I don't mention it a whole lot. I never mention it because I always feel weird about it, but it's there. People ask sometimes about it. Yes, on the P2 Podcast page, there is a little PayPal tip jar deal. We don't do sponsors here. We don't ask for money or subscriptions to the podcast. It's all perfectly free. But some people do feel compelled sometimes to say, hey, man, come on, Phil. I want to drop you a little money. $5, $100, whatever. Just PayPal it, man, right there, a little tip jar. If you want to, great. If you don't, fine. Just know that if you do send me some money, you're going to get a little email from me saying, hey, man, you shouldn't have, but thank you very much, Phil. So, do that at your leisure. We thank all of you who do that from time to time. Some of y'all, it's the same guy all the time, just throwing money in there. I always appreciate it. It never goes unnoticed. I hope you always get my thank you emails, because I am very, very grateful for it. So, seek that out. It's there. The little tip jar on the P2 Podcast page. Brought to you by yourselves. You own the show. You fans. Y'all own my whole career. You know, like somebody said, take care of your fans and they'll take care of you. Who do you think pays my mortgage, man? All you guys out there having your birthday parties and your festivals and your backyard functions and graduation things for your kids, and you're inviting the full band to come in, or you're inviting me to bring my guitar and play, and I sit over there while you're cooking hot dogs, play some songs. That's what we do, man. Or showing up at the Common Table or the White Elephant or the Mansion or the Firehouse or the Surf Club or wherever we are, and buying CDs and whatever else. Y'all are the reason we do it, the reason I'm here. I don't say it often enough. There you go. I can't say it enough. Thank you, fans. Phil here on another beautiful day here at the Pritchett Compound. Man, just still freaking out over this Phil Collins Alamo deal. This could be a huge break, a huge emerging deal in the career combination of Texas independence, Texas spirit, and my love of Texas independence and my love of British rock. There's just some kind of a merger here that I sense I need to be a part of. We'll see how that all plays out very, very soon. I'll keep you updated. Well, speaking of the Alamo, speaking of history, speaking of war, speaking of independence, battles, revolution, let me tell you something, man. There's a book you need to read out there. I don't have it in front of me. I never bring any notes to these shows. I'm just talking off the top of my head. So if I get someone's name wrong or a date wrong or something, I apologize in advance. I'm not sitting here reading notes. I'm just sitting here looking at a cup of coffee and a microphone. I recently read a book. Man, I've been looking for a good book to read for a long time. I love reading history. I was a history major in college, as I've said 1,000,000,000 times. love reading history, or at least historical fiction, or you know, biographies, that kind of thing. It's kind of what I've always been really into the most, more so than a novel where you just go, well, the guy just made it up, you know, which is still great. Of course, I got my favorites out there. Lonesome Dove, I don't know, whatever. Sure, there's lots of great stuff. But, oh, man, something like The Things They Carried, written by, what's that guy's name? Oh, jeez. Oh, the Vietnam book. I met him. He did this Highland Park Literary Festival deal. His name is not in front of me right here, as I just said. The Things They Carried, though. It's his account of fighting in Vietnam. Fantastic book. I read that a while back. That was the last really good book I read. Until this book I'm going to talk about right now. 1776. You hear what I said? 1776. Written by our old friend McCullough. David McCullough? I think it was just David. David McCullough, the great historian, great writer. Everything he writes is great. I read his biography on Harry Truman. You're thinking, Harry Truman, big deal. What's he all about, Phil? Well, let me tell you what. McCullough wrote a book about 6 inches thick called Truman several years ago. And my dad gave it to me. Man, you gotta check this book out. It's great. And I'm like, oh, Harry Truman. I don't know. What's so interesting about him? Let me tell you what. Everything's the answer to that. This Harry Truman comes from Missouri. How he came up through the ranks. An honest guy. A laid-back guy. Becomes Roosevelt. FDR's vice president. He's just there. Is that right? Yeah, he was FDR's vice president, I believe. And anyway, so he ends up becoming president. Runs for president. And, you know, it's a hell of a great story. Respected guy. And you really come away from that book with a real appreciation for Harry Truman. How tough he was. And in ending World War II. His conflict with Douglas MacArthur afterward. But McCullough's a really great writer. You know, these historical events are all... Everyone's like, well, that's boring or that's whatever. It kind of depends on the storyteller a little bit, doesn't it? I mean, is love boring to listen to or hear about? Well, not if the Beatles are telling you about it, it's not. Not if Bob Dylan's telling you about it, it's fascinating. But some crap songwriter, yeah, it's boring. It's him talking about his girlfriend. It's just like, oh, God, you're skipping it. Like, well, you don't like love? It's not love. It's not youth or innocence that I'm against. It's just the way this guy's telling me about it. So you can look back through history, man. Everybody's got a story. Every nondescript president or building, there's some story. There's some reason it's there. And if some guy can get all the facts and arrange them and tell it in a compelling fashion, it's a real art form, man, if you really stop and think about it. A lot of guys, I think, say, man, I'm going to write history. Well, I'll just get all the facts on whatever, the Alamo or World War II. We'll line them all up and sell it. Everyone will learn more about the war. Well, it's easier said than done, isn't it? You got to present it in a certain way. You've got to tell it from someone's perspective. You've got to find the humanity in there. Letters he wrote to his mother. I don't know, the things he worried about. Well, McCullough, David McCullough, is a fantastic historical writer in that sense. He really gets to the human being behind the big name. And never is that more evident with his book, which I had never heard of, 1776. I was a McCullough fan. I was in Half Price Books just wandering around, waiting for something to grab me. I do that sometime. And there's 70s. I see McCullough, and I was like, oh, wow, it's right next to Truman and some other books of his that I've read. I said, well, I didn't know he wrote one on the American Revolution, which we all think to ourselves, well, we know Washington and, you know, the Declaration of Independence and Valley Forge and Bunker Hill. We know all about the American Revolution, right? Well, do you? I tell you what, I'm a history major. I love it. I was ashamed by what I didn't know. You start kind of reading through there. You're like, wait a minute. What happened first, the Boston Massacre, the Boston Tea Party, or Bunker Hill, or Lexington and Concord? What's the chain of events? What was going on? How long did the war last? When was it officially over? And you kind of realize real fast that you really don't know the nuts and bolts of the whole thing. You just remember we won, and these were the guys who were heroes in the whole thing. So I set about reading 1776 with kind of your basic smattering of elementary school 4th of July knowledge that any of you may have. So not very much. Well, it's kind of critical that he's just covering 1776. The war with England was not officially over till I think 1783. with the Treaty of Paris, I believe it was, that officially ended the war. Anyway, so 1776 starts, and just like in the Truman book, we really got behind Truman's humanity and insecurities and all that. He does that in this book very, very well, behind none other than our hero, George Washington. You know of whom I speak, right? George Washington, the first official president of the United States, the leader of the Continental Army, a Virginian, a man of character and repute. It's fascinating. The one thing that just cuts through this book, and it's not just McCullough's book, his words, it's all the letters and description. And remember, this is before Washington had won the war, was what kind of a leader and presence George freaking Washington had. Had to have been something so astounding for that era, or any era, because every account of him is just in such comically superhero glowing terms. It's almost a little ponderous because you're just like, wait a minute, no one really knows it. I mean, he was a general. He was a big landowner, of course, from Virginia, and an accomplished soldier. But he had never led an army before. He'd never fought, you know, leading an army. He had been placed in charge of the Continental Army by John Adams and the guys in Philadelphia at the Continental Congress, and he was the leader. And man, there are just so many letters in there McCullough has accounts from, soldiers riding home to their wives, or sleeping in the mud. It's terrible. But General Washington appeared on a ridge, looking like a god of nothing I have ever seen before, a man of character and demeanor unforeseen in this world. Stuff like that. Just like, what? Or some of his young generals who work for Washington. Talk about how he walks into a room dressed to the nines. They said he never looked anything less than spick and span. He always said, man, you can't only be the general. You've got to act the part. You've got to demand respect to be the general, to be a leader. And he demanded nothing less from his men. One thing that was fascinating, so early on, they're kind of getting this army together. One of the big problems is Washington's a Southerner. He's a Virginian. Jefferson, is in the Congress, wrote the Declaration in the year of 1776. Is trying to get the army together, and the difference between the Southern ranks, the Virginian kind of guys, and the New Englanders, the guys up in Boston and stuff. And Washington does not hide his worry or at times his contempt for the Yankee fighters. He's just like, these people, golly, they're just dirty. They live on potatoes, and they just Washington was somewhat of a regal king, a plantation owner from Virginia. So he's up there in Boston trying to lead these guys that, they're just living in the mud in Boston in some chicken farm, and they're just a lot cruder and a lot they don't dress as nice, and they're tough, but he admires their toughness. And the bottom line of the whole early years of the army is it's just a disaster, one disaster after another. So the book picks up 1776. The British occupy Boston. That's just of course, we're the English colonies. So you've already had the Boston Tea Party. You've already had Lexington and Concord, where the British tried to take arms from the Americans and they shot them back. Bunker Hill, which was, the Battle of Bunker Hill had already been fought, which was, I think, considered an American victory. Even though the British stayed in Boston, they had a ton of casualties, and the British were astounded that they took so many casualties, that the Americans killed so many of their guys. All those rabble rousing, squatting in the mud, New England, types had fought the redcoats that tough. So the British occupy, Boston. So the first cool thing that happens in the book is one of Washington's young generals. So Washington, the British have Boston. There's these hills above Boston, the Dorchester Heights. And Washington says, man, we have got to secure a big city. We've got to take command somewhere. We have to start somewhere. They were just kind of a loose-fit network of guerrilla fighters strewn around the woods of New England. And the East Coast is really all the Continental Army was. So Washington said, man, we need to establish fortification. We need to make our presence known. We need to occupy a big city. So he sets his sight on the Dorchester Heights, the hills above Boston. And he realizes, very candidly in the book, he has no ships. They have no boats at all. And they have no cannons. He's like, so this is not going to be easily achieved. Well, one of his young generals, a guy named Henry Knox, says, hey, I know where there are some cannons at Fort Ticonderoga. I forget where Ticonderoga was, but I think it was an old fort, an old French fort maybe, from the French and Indian War way back before all this stuff, back when France and Britain were fighting over this, a lot of this country. And Knox says, man, there's got to be 30, 40 cannon up there. I'll tell you what, if I can get the cannon and get them back here to Boston, we'll have cannon. So Washington just kind of, I mean, what does he have to lose? He's like, well, you can take some men with you. He said, yeah, I'll take a few guys and we'll see you later. Well, Washington sends them off. He didn't even know these guys. He thinks he'd never maybe even see these guys again. So young Henry Knox, confident, capable, young leader, just sets off for Ticonderoga. It's like in the winter, cause they're going to need the ice so they can slide these guns, the cannon, which is extremely heavy, of course, on sleds and stuff. So they set off in the fall, in the early part of the year, hoping to catch some of the snow coming back, you know, in January, February, I think is when it was, 1776, and slide the cannon back to Boston. Well, Washington just goes, well, we'll see how this works out. Well, sure enough, man, this young guy comes back. He's got all these guns. He's gone over a couple times crossing rivers. The ice gave way, and the guns went to the bottom of the lake. But they had them tied up, and they hoisted them ashore. They didn't lose a single damn gun, and Washington is astounded when Henry Knox shows up with all these cannons from Fort Ticonderoga. The guns of Ticonderoga. You heard that expression? I had it. I didn't really know what it meant, but here they are. The guns of Ticonderoga are in Boston. So Washington says, great, man. All right, we need a little luck. We need to get to the top of these hills without the British seeing us doing it, or they're going to blow us to kingdom come. And so they can't take days to build a bunch of forts and stuff up there. He goes, man, I'm going to have to do this like overnight one day. So they're waiting. They finally get this dark night with a fog. So these guys just take out Washington, just hell bent for leather, up the Dorchester Heights, hauling guns all night long, not knowing if they're going to make it. They're stacking up earth. They stack up all these barrels full of like rocks and nails and all this stuff up on the hills, so if the British decide to charge the hills, they can just turn these things, they can just roll these things down the hills at them. And they just set up all these ramparts and all this fortification up there on Dorchester Heights, looking right down in Boston. And sure enough, there's some great accounts in there that McCullough finds from British generals who wake up the next morning in Boston, you know, look out at the harbor, have their cup of tea, and just peer up to see all these cannons, just these ramparts, these fortifications. And they look up and they're just like, son of a bitch. And so they're like, man, the Americans have fortified in one night what it would take me and my troops 3 months to do. We are under siege. We're under guns. We have no choice but to retreat. So that's what happens. Do the British, they're up there at the fort, Washington, and they see the British retreat and they leave Boston. Another huge problem that I didn't really realize the magnitude of it was everybody in Boston and most of these cities love the British. They are British. They're British citizens. And if you're a successful lawyer or shopkeeper or doctor, you treat British troops, you're in good with the crown, you're a loyalist. You know what I mean? You don't have any interest in handing your salvation over to a bunch of muck guys in the dirt, you know, up there who point with guns pointed at your city. So there was a lot of loyalist trouble. People in town tipping off British troops to what Washington and the army were doing. Lots of defections from Washington's own army. Not just spies and people going over to the British, but guys just saying, screw this, and just going home to their fort. The army had no shoes. It was freezing cold. There was mud. There was no food. Everybody had dysentery. The accounts from the camps of Washington's army are just dreadful. I mean, you can imagine living in 1776 was hard enough, living in a nice cabin, growing your own food and slaughtering your own chickens, much less out in the woods, just trying to, you know, stay healthy and stay fed. And it's just impossible. So they're always out of supplies. Guys are just always dying left and right, freezing to death. It's just a disaster. Washington, there's so many accounts of him just going, man, we might be sunk. This is never going to work. But no doubt that first Ticonderoga guns a Ticonderoga. Get the British out of Boston. Well, then what happens, Phil? I'll tell you what happens. Then those British ships start showing up. Word gets back. Keep in mind, it takes months for the, you know, carriers to get all the way to England. Then, you know, the Americans have taken Boston. So there's a lot of accounts from the soldiers just saying, man, we looked in horror as just 10 ships showed up, 20 ships, 30 ships every day in the harbor till there's like 200 British ships, guns, men at full sail in the harbor of Boston. Just looking. There's just kind of this stalemate. And then they recede and they head all the ships. Most of the ships kind of head to New York to make sure and fortify and occupy New York. And that's where Washington heads out. So it's a great account, man, of the travails, the things that really, the issues that you just don't think about when you see, George Washington, hero of our country, was just the hardship, man, and the kind of leader he was and the kind of respect he demanded, from his men. And there was one great scene where, after Washington takes Boston, General Howe, the big British troop, says, look, we'll recede out of Boston, but let's make a peace agreement. We don't want any bloodshed. The British were really pretty accommodating. I mean, if you really look at the book, I mean, they didn't want to sit there and shoot all their own people. They wanted the rebellion to be somewhat subsided and placated. Just look, y'all just stay out there in the woods. We're not going to bother you. They didn't want some big bloody fight, really. I mean, why would they? So they're trying to. So they send word to Washington by means of this courier. So one day, this British guy's coming over to, I guess when they're up at Fort Ticonderoga guns in Boston, and this British guy comes over under a white flag. He's got an envelope that says, Mr. Washington. Says, this is for Mr. Washington. And Washington's got two of his scouts down there, and they just look at the envelope and say, I'm sorry, there's no one here by that name. The guy's like, for the leader, for Mr. Washington? They just look at the note and go, there is no one here by that name. So he goes, okay. So he goes back to Howe and said, they said there wasn't anybody by that name. So Howe's like, what? So he writes George Washington on the envelope, sends it back. The guys look at it. There's no one here by that name. They're like, Mr. George Washington. But they say, sir, there is no one here by that name in this army. If you'd like to speak with our leader, you can address him as His Excellency General Washington, Esquire. The guy's like, okay. So this is how Washington operated, man. I love it. Boy, where are the leaders like that today? You're telling me all we can get is a bunch of lawyers from Yale and Harvard? Good Lord. So one of these guys, he goes back to Howe and says, hey, they ain't taking it. So Howe writes again. So finally they do show up. The guy comes in with a formal request. Just if it will not convenience, our General Mr. Howe requests an audience with His Excellency General George Washington, Esquire, if it please him. And the two scouts said, by all means, sir, right this way. So the guy finally gets in. Is it Washington just standing there in full dress to receive the British general? Great stuff, man. A leader and a man who knew how to conduct his business. Really inspiring stuff. But man, oh man, what is so real in this, though, is Washington's anguish. Him thinking himself not up to the task in his own letters. Just, we are doomed. We're finished. These New Englander guys are sick and they're drunk and they're running off and they're defecting and they're stealing things. And not only that, the town is full of loyalists there's no way. And the Americans do get pushed around all of 1776 after the takeover of Boston. They get whooped around New York and get pushed across the Delaware River. And Washington's back on the other side. So this is kind of the famous, I believe this is the time, the painting Washington crossing the Delaware is because he was on this other side of the Delaware from New Jersey. And the British, and then the cold sets in late December, 1776. And, this is when Washington just kind of has an all out attack. He just goes, look, we're gonna have to get in the boats, sail in the snow, in the ice, break through the ice and get over to New Jersey, I think it was Princeton, New Jersey and Trenton, New Jersey. And they have two big battles there, that the Americans win. in spite of everything. I mean, you remember, they got 200 British ships out here. They don't have any boats. They have any cannon. But they go in there and they just butcher the hell out of these redcoats at Trenton and Princeton. And that was Christmas Eve, or Christmas night is when they had the attack. They knew the British would be kind of drinking and hanging out in cold weather. You know, the British were very proper gentlemen. They said, this is not campaign season, they would say. This is not campaign season during the snow. Campaign season is in the spring and the summer when the weather's nice, you know. So they were kind of hunkered down for the winter. Washington just gets his guys. In the dead of winter, in the snowstorm, they go over there and just kick ass. And so it was kind of then, December, Christmas, 1776, a few months after the Declaration had been signed in July. Washington had army had been beaten and whooped all over New England, but kind of right here at the end of 1776, Washington has a few big victories, and word starts to go from New York all over the colonies that... Because no one had any faith in the rebellion. Everyone was like, man, this is fruitless, or those guys are stupid, or British people. And they said that that's when people really started to take it seriously. Late 1776, that man Washington has whooped the British at Princeton and at Trenton, and they hold New Jersey, and it's a whole new ball game. So it is a cool framework just to for McCullough to take 1776. That one pivotal year that began with a victory in Boston and ended with a victory in New Jersey. In the middle, nothing but disaster, death, and men freezing to death and getting hanged and all kinds of awful stuff. And everybody doubting and hating the Americans as a bunch of dirty, thieving, soulless vermin. But yet, here we are, folks. The British are not here. George Washington, man. There he is. Well... David McCullough, 1776. It's a quick read. And man, I couldn't put it down. My wife was waking up at 3 a.m. She's going, what are you doing? I'm just reading this book. I'm like, I was just Washington then knew he had to attack. I'm just I'm looking at the clock. It's 2 a.m. I'm like, oh my God, why am I reading this stupid book? I was up all night, read it in like 3 days. 1776. David McCullough. Well, there's a little history lesson for you folks. American history on the heels of our Texas history and Phil Collins of Genesis last week. Hey, man, you get it all with this show. The music, the recording, the writing, the business, and a little history thrown in. I can't help it. It's who I am, man, you know. So, that is all we have for this week, folks, on the podcast. Phil Pritchett here. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for all y'all for hitting the tip jar there on the site, P2 Podcast Tip Jar. Send me whatever. I'll send you a thank you note, a thank you email. Hope you don't mind. So, call us 817-733-5256 or email me phil@philpritchett.com. We'll come play your party wherever it is, or come record at the studio. We'd love to have you, and I've been having a great time of it there of late with so many projects going on. So look us up, come see us. We're here for you in Fort Worth. We'll see y'all out at the shows here very soon, folks. Be good to each other until our next show next week. Much tougher.